dealing with the annoyances of daily life. It could be like a child who keeps asking the same question or keeps interrupting the parent while they're trying to work. All these things, like, you can learn to welcome the dynorphin effect in itself. In a way, it's like the essence of impatience. I often say that impatience is like wine and patience drinks it. What patience does is just drinks in the feeling of impatience. I think that's an image of what it's like to get through a wave of dynorphins. And that's how we reshape ourselves.
Before we get started, if you enjoy these episodes, you might want to explore more at optimalwork.com. Our website offers unique content, tools, and exercises to help you thrive at work and beyond. We have an in-depth masterclass, which covers our entire theory of growth. We have daily recommendations for personalized advice, and we have a platform to help groups and organizations learn and practice optimal work together. You can get a free trial at optimalwork.com. Now let's get started with today's episode. Hey, this is Sharif, here with another episode of the Optimal Work Podcast, joined by Dr. Kevin Majors. Kevin, good to be back here with you again.
Hey, Sharif, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, of course. Well, Kevin, last week we talked a little bit, you introduced, maybe for the first time on the podcast, the dynorphin effect or dynorphins. And, you know, I just think it's very interesting. And one popular figure now is Wim Hof in popular culture, who's known for his astounding feats. I think we've mentioned him before, and probably many of our listeners know about him. But I thought, you know, this episode we could dive into dynorphins and what they mean and how to utilize them and so forth.
Yeah, that sounds great. I'll preface this just by saying it is a very complex topic. So what I'm trying to do, as we get into things, I'll try to keep things like very simple. But once you get into the weeds, oh man, it isn't, you just go down and down and down. It's trying to understand there's, you know, six types of dynorphins and they join with other opioids. And so it gets really complicated. But in general, dynorphins can be thought of as the opposite of endorphins. So drugs like normal opioids that people think of, you know, like painkillers, but also heroin, they stimulate two types of opioid receptors, Mu and Delta. But there's this opposite kind of opioid receptor that they don't touch. That is the one for dynorphins. So it's called Kappa. So dynorphins seem to, like, basically Kappa does the opposite of the other kinds of opioid receptors. That's why you can think of dynorphins as just having the opposite effect of endorphins. Endorphins make you feel great and motivated. Dynorphins make you feel bad. You get dysphoria. It's called anhedonia, where you're just not enjoying anything. You feel unmotivated. You feel tired. You feel anxious. So dynorphins are really aversive. What's interesting about them is they just seem to be the key ingredient and everything that we experience as difficult or aversive. So that difficult feeling or the intolerable feeling that challenges can sometimes have may be entirely due to dynorphins. At least, you know, this seems to be like they're a big part of the explanation. And we're only now getting to know more about this system.
Okay, two quick clarifying questions to get a little bit of the like kind of scientific context here. So endorphins, you say, you know, that it's related to they make you feel motivated. And when I think of motivation, I also think of dopamine. So is there a relationship mm-hmm. here with the whole dopamine system, and endorphins are related to dopamine? Or I don't know if you can just explain
yeah,
that a little bit.
Yeah, and so these are two different systems, but they relate to each other. So, and in some way, it appears that if something stimulates dynorphins, then it doesn't get, so the dopamine system doesn't attach onto it. The dynorphin system makes anti-rewards, or what do you call punishers. So it's kind of punishing. So for instance, if people take a drug of abuse like cocaine or marijuana, and while they're intoxicated, for reasons we don't understand, they get the dynorphin effect while intoxicated. That would go along with them feeling acutely anxious or distressed in the midst of the intoxication, it turns out then that those people are not going to be addicted to marijuana or cocaine. Like having a bad experience while intoxicated leads to them, it just blocks the ability of these, normally they would hijack your dopamine system. So in some ways, the dynorphin effect seems to protect us from hijack. But it's a bit of a double-edged sword. It seems like the purpose of dynorphins is that things that trigger them, it's a natural positive punishment. A positive punisher is just something that actually makes you feel pain or feel bad. A negative punishment would be something like withholding a reward. You know, like, you know, if you don't finish your homework, you won't be able to have dessert. You know, that would be a negative punisher. The positive punisher would be, I don't know, actually spanking someone. So not that I'm in favor of that, but that would be like a positive punishment. Dynorphins seem to be like nature's first line of positive punishment for things that it wants us to be careful about doing so that we get this intolerable feeling while doing them. So that's why being in cold, extreme cold, like plunging into cold water gives you a huge wave of dynorphin and you feel like I have to get out. So almost like there's a tunnel vision that forms, you know, negatively, like I have to get out of this situation. So in some ways, opioids are always related to that kind of tunneling of attention. But in the case of like, so if you go into cold water, the goal, in fact, if you do cold water exposure is to say you're in the water is 59 degrees Fahrenheit. The goal is to be in there for 5 minutes. And the idea is that you should get at least three or maybe four waves of these dynorphins where you feel the urge, like, I just have to get out. And then you learn to mindfully get through the wave. And then you get another one and you get through it and another one. So at least you want three waves. That actually radically increases your tolerance for cold. And it leads to then afterwards, a huge endorphin effect where for like 2 days later, you feel great. You feel motivated and focused. So just to complete this thing while we're talking about cold exposures, if the water is 49 degrees Fahrenheit, it takes 30 seconds to get these waves. To get the successive waves.
So you get one Wim wave Hof, every 10 seconds there.
Something like that. Yeah. This is from what the, this is like maybe lore, but this is kind of commonly accepted lore about these things. Wim Hof was able to go in 32 degree Fahrenheit water for 2 hours. So, which is the world record actually. So, you know, completely, it's a, so some of his feats are just astounding. He's also developed ways of heating his body from the inside using his brown fat. Learning how to voluntarily activate it to generate heat. People can look that up. The point here is that if you push up on dynorphins voluntarily, say by doing the cold exposure, you get this then couple days bounce of endorphin that's very powerful. But with the drug of abuse, say if people take cocaine, they're pushing up deliberately on the endorphin system, and then they get 3 to up to 7 days of dynorphin. So again, that should be nature telling them, don't do this again. Like, oh, I did it. I felt great at the time, but then it felt really bad for a long time. But what happens if people get the wrong lesson? And while they're feeling down, like in the depths of the dynorphin effect, they use the drug again. Well, this is what creates a vicious cycle then of addiction. So that then, yes, they do feel momentarily better, not as good as the first time. But then they get an even deeper dynorphin wave. So technically we would say dynorphins then can be go from being a positive punisher, which they should have learned the lesson, to being a negative reinforcer. Now people do the drug just to make the craving, the feeling bad, just to make that stop. So eventually in the midst of addiction, people never even get into positive territory with their mood. It's just less bad while they're using the drug. So that's the real end of like the vicious cycle. They get more and more stuck in the dynorphin effect.
Before we continue, a brief message. If you're benefiting from these discussions, please hit like and subscribe to our channel. Doing so helps us reach more people. So you're not just learning yourself, you're helping others discover a path to growth and flourishing too. Thanks so much for your support. Enjoy the rest of the episode. So it seems like, I mean, you mentioned cocaine, but there are also examples from everyday life, right? Of putting off a task that makes that you know, you don't want to engage it. You get dynorphins when you start working on, or at least you get stressed. So then my question is, are all of these vicious cycles of everyday life of procrastination, anxiety, and so is in general, is challenge avoidance going to involve dynorphins, or are there different things at play in the different types of situations?
Yeah. So that's a very good point. When people are, the relief people get, say when they avoid something they're scared of, say you were scheduled to give a talk and you were just so scared about giving it and then it's canceled. Like, and you get a wave of relief. Okay. That's actually an endorphin effect. So you can tell that this system is involved there. So what happens with like the positive reinforcing aspect of relief, you know, is likely all mediated by endorphin. And the intolerable feeling of the thing hanging over you, that's the dynorphin effect. And so ordinarily, everything that's aversive to us, to the degree that it's feeling aversive right now, it's because dynorphins are present. So this doesn't just happen in extremes of substances and behaviors. I think this is, at least this is what the research is all suggesting. This is really integral to understanding how reinforcement works.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, with any challenge, so and engaging any challenge is going to be pushing up on the dynorphins and leading to this kind of virtuous cycle of becoming better able to handle dynorphins.
Yeah. And we're now, this is of course seen in more perhaps clearly in things like the effect of sauna, you know, on this system. So being in a sauna, you get the same dynorphin effect and you get these waves of like, I have to get out, you know, and as you acclimate your body, you want to be able to go like 20 minutes in the sauna. Fasting is like this. Fasting clearly has this dynorphin effect. So, and as people learn to welcome the waves of the dynorphins, you know, what they end up getting, even when they're just, say, doing a long-term fast, after the day three or four, you know, like after day three, usually in a long fast, people often, their mood just goes really high and they just feel great. They can kind of get euphoric. So it seems like they got through the dynorphin waves and now they're getting the compensating endorphin wave. So dynorphins, like they're involved in anything that is kind of what we would say is mortifying. Like it's the essence of what makes something mortifying or aversive. So that means then every challenge to the extent that it is a kind of mortification is actually a way of bringing on deliberately the dynorphin effect.
Yeah. So, okay, then what's the goal here? Because it seems like you're talking about, creating or generating a virtuous cycle of bringing on dynorphins, pushing up on dynorphins, being able to handle, I don't know if the dynorphin load increases or something like that, but then you just get more and more resistant or able to tolerate or engage dynorphins. And then, so is the goal to just like kind of be able to do that in with greater and greater challenges and like, you know,
would be a certain approach. I would call that a bronze approach technically, but that would be challenge for challenge's sake. Like I am just going to get myself tougher. So I'm going to find ways of just pushing my dynorphin system as hard as it can go up. I'll do cold exposure alternating with heat exposure while fasting and so, and you know, and not using the back of a chair, you know, standing on one leg. Okay. Yeah. So you could go like longer and longer, like pushing up on the dynorphins. Now it turns out that the humans are just incredibly shapeable once they break through the avoidance of dynorphin. So you could, like Wim Hof can train people in like 2 days to go up Mount Everest barefoot or something like, here's these crazy things where you have these training camps. And I'm not an expert in Wim Hof, by the way. This is just stuff I've gleaned, you know, here and there. But he can take ordinary people and get them to, you know, climb these. I mean, Mount Everest and Mount Kilimanjaro are two ones he's done barefoot with shorts only, and he's led teams. It can be up to -20 degrees Fahrenheit without wind chill. And that's just an incredible thing. And what people learn from dealing with these Wim Hof things is that that the body is so powerful. It, you know, we tend to protect it, and maybe we're so protective of our comfort that we developed a bit of a phobia of dynorphins, you know, and then you get more and more intolerant of them. Well, distress intolerance correlates with all psychopathology. So, you know, anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, whatnot. All of that, there's this common theme in them of the inability to tolerate distress. So one general kind of way of starting to treat this is teaching people distress tolerance. Now that we know more about dynorphins, you know, and like when the original distress tolerance framework was developed, that was like before we really knew much about the system at all. Now that we know it, it really does seem to be that you're talking about dynorphin tolerance. So yeah, you could be more and more tolerating of dynorphin. Okay, well, I'm not sure that's a really like great end. And to me, this is just like learning how to tolerate adrenaline. Okay, so with adrenaline, it's one thing to tolerate its presence. You know, like when you're doing some exposure exercises for anxiety, you're afraid of heights, you go to a very high balcony, you learn to tolerate that adrenaline that comes. In fact, along with the adrenaline is dynorphin if it feels intolerable. So you're actually doing like a double exposure. You're learning how to welcome the dynorphin and the adrenaline when they're coming together. But is the goal that people do ever more daring exposures? Is it, you know, do they need to be dangling from a helicopter? You know, probably not. But that's, you start to like ask yourself, what's the point? One thing is, it's great to know that we can break through the dynorphin effect, and you can teach yourself to tolerate what previously had seemed intolerable, and the body just shifts. And so people can handle more and more. Well, maybe a higher level is being able to be fully accepting of the dynorphin effect, so you can just welcome it without having to push through effortfully. But even higher is being able to utilize it for meaningful growth. And that's identical to adrenaline. We don't want people just becoming adrenaline junkies, you know, just like we don't want people just chasing dynorphins for dynorphin's sake. But it is a gateway to virtuous cycles. Now, adrenaline helps you stretch your behavior in new ways and to reach peak performances you couldn't have done before, so that those can be habituated and learned. And that even includes things like being more courageous, being more generous, being more, I don't know, open and loving. You know, all these things, you know, adrenaline can assist. So the goal isn't adrenaline for adrenaline's sake. It's actually the growth that it helps you to attain by giving you an oomph for the stretch. But dynorphins are very similar. It seems to me that the whole question is like, why are people, you know, what's the virtuous cycle that they're actually aiming to grow in? And that could be a skill, it could be an ideal, it could be a bond. What's the thing that somehow learning to like utilize a dynorphins to like the embracing of dynorphin to get there will help them? I don't know
That makes sense. So now, okay, I think now we can just to shift a little bit. So to apply that to kind of everyday life, ordinary life, what people are going to be experiencing, because some of the examples that we've been giving of where the dynorphins come in, which I think helps make it very concrete for people, is cold exposure or the sauna you mentioned, probably exercise is another one, like when you get to the point right where you want to stop.
Anything that feels intolerable, anything.
Okay, so then that applies to any situation in a conversation with someone where, I don't know, maybe you want the conversation to end or something. So
because you're studying in the library and someone keeps clicking their pen. Little things like that, things that annoy us. To the point when it feels intolerable, that's like, okay, that would be what you'd be going for. So if you were trying to study in the library and someone keeps clicking their pen, you could learn to get through waves of dynorphins. So to be embracing it just the same way.
Okay. Well, that's great. Next time I'm in the library and I hear someone clicking their pen, I'll remind myself of that.
So anyone annoys you can give you a chance to say, hey, this is a perfect, safe dynorphin workout. There's no chance, like with Wim Hof, his optical nerves actually froze once and he went blind while swimming under an iceberg. So that was extremely dangerous. Well, dealing with the annoyances of daily life, it could be like a child who keeps asking the same question or keeps interrupting the parent while they're trying to work. All these things, like you can learn to welcome the dynorphin effect in itself. In a way, it's like the essence of impatience. I often say that impatience is like wine and patience drinks it. What patience does is just drinks in the feeling of impatience. I think that's an image of what it's like to get through a wave of dynorphins. And that's how we reshape ourselves.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, yeah, maybe I'd just like to also get your thoughts about this in the context of bonds with other people and relationships. So it seems like dynorphins are essential to be kind of patience, to being able to sacrifice or to engage some kind of difficulty. And sacrifice is kind of an essential component of really loving other people, that you have to be able to undergo mm-hmm. difficulty and sacrifice for their good. So, can you explore that connection a little bit? Or,
yeah, if you think of the most powerful ideals that actually make us bondable, one of them is clearly humility. And humility allows us to be kind of vulnerable enough and open enough and then self-forgetting enough to form real bonds with others. So humility, I think, is the quality that most makes us vulnerable. Well, the pain that has to be welcomed in humility is the pain of shame. That there's a fear of somehow not looking good in the eyes of others, or maybe of not being reciprocated, or of there's something there that we'd be disgraced in the eyes of others that we could be afraid of. That's what shame is that fear of disgrace in the eyes of others. Well, that's what keeps people, if they're not able to welcome that discomfort, if they find it intolerable, then they become kind of like they put themselves into a fortress or a tower. They don't let themselves be open enough to other people to actually bond with them. And so maybe there is just this facade that they keep up to keep up the appearances. And that facade ends up being something that no one can break through to actually bond with them. But that's all shame avoidance. Humility is dropping facades to let people see us as we really are, warts and all, as whatever it might be, and then actually have the possibility of really bonding. So I think that's like, dynorphins are really clearly involved in all of that, the intolerable aspect of shame. Similarly, I think just with putting the needs of others ahead of our own, being generous, generosity always means that we are prioritizing the other person and their good. And that means letting go of the prioritization of our own good. Not completely. I mean, it's not like, not that we lose ourselves. But in small ways, at least, we learn to be giving and generous and to let go of little attachments for the sake of making others kind of more pleased. So I think even there, there's, this idea of be generous until it hurts. I think Mother Teresa would say that. Well, the hurt is the dynorphins. And so the limit on how much you grow in generosity is how willing are you to welcome dynorphins in that domain, in that area. So in some ways, there's always going to be, if we're going to build up a virtuous cycle, the virtuous cycle will give us greater mastery and meaning and enjoyment. So that means that there is an endorphin effect that's built into every virtuous cycle. That means then we can just bet that you have to pay the price up front. Embrace the dynorphin effect. Embrace the discomfort so that you can engage in the behavior that will gradually then build and build in meaning and mastery and in actual enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Kevin, I have one last question for you. I guess part of what it sounds like we're saying here is that every challenge brings on dynorphins. And if you avoid the dynorphins or the challenge, and seek kind of endorphins or relief or mm-hmm. ease, you end up getting more challenge and more dynorphins, and it's a vicious cycle. Whereas if you mm-hmm. embrace and push up on it, gets easier, you get a virtuous cycle, you get more endorphins. So this sounds like something that you've been talking about for like 15 years in terms of challenge avoidance, challenge engagement, vicious cycles, and stuff. So, but whereas the discovery of dynorphins is relatively recent. So what has this specific lens of dynorphin, as opposed to just thinking about it at the level of psychology and challenge, kind of added to your understanding? And, you know, what does it give any more kind of practical guidance for us as we do engage these challenges, as we strive to live our ideals?
Yeah, it's a great question. And in some way, knowing what is happening inside of us teaches us cause and effect, and that is a kind of wisdom. Wisdom is always trying to get to the causes of things. And the more language we have to describe causes, the better. And this is a kind of material cause. So it's a part of understanding our own subjectivity and what we experience and putting words to it. So I think that without the word dynorphin, you might not have a way to describe the waves you have of intolerability that come over you as you're trying to do something virtuous. And that there might be a few waves that you have to get through. So just this idea of that there's a wave, I think it's great to have this concept that could be due to the dynorphin system kicking in, making sure you know what you're doing, but that also is a predictor then that there's a virtuous cycle on the other side. So it doesn't tell us that virtuous cycle is something meaningful in itself that we want to go for, because you could acclimate yourself to all sorts of uncomfortable things and it may not serve anything. But if it clearly does, if it's clearly linked to, say, a bond, well, then I think it just makes it that much more welcomeable. So you're able to say, okay, this is great. Bring it on. The more, the better. It also tells us that, something about the benefit, perhaps, of maintaining a kind of dynorphin tone, that there's always a little bit of an element of challenge going on, that could actually be protective against all vicious cycles. So you're going to be much less likely to flee things you shouldn't flee or to approach things you shouldn't approach while you have this like force field around you of, a moderate amount of the dynorphin effect. So I think just a moderate amount is enough to change how rewarding your rewards are, and then allows you to more freely choose them. This is why perhaps there has been research that I heard Rhonda Patrick cite this. I haven't been able to find it, but she cites research about sauna use being a treatment for alcoholism. That when people learn in the sauna to get through these waves, and she talks about dynorphins, and that's actually where I first learned about it, to get through these waves of dynorphins, that seems to be teaching people who struggle with alcohol how to get through waves of craving. Because what makes the wave of craving intolerable is this dynorphin effect. It's also why traditionally fasting has been seen as a way of breaking all bad habits, no matter what the bad habit is. But this is telling us that maybe this is the mechanism, that it's in fact, once you start to feel this dynorphin effect and see it as a good sign, this is the key to shaping yourself. Then you can learn to welcome it. But I think the whole value of it just determines on what is the end you're actually seeking. The higher the end that you're seeking, the more worthwhile it is to pursue dynorphins if they're on that path.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful, Kevin. Okay, you've answered all my questions on this topic.
Well, thank you for your questions, Shreve. These are, as always, great questions.
Awesome. Good, Kevin. Well, thanks so much for all your answers. All right.
Till next time.
We'll be back next week. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. If you enjoyed our conversation and you're looking for more in-depth guidance, check out optimalwork.com, our platform of content, tools, and exercises that will help you thrive at work and beyond. See you next week.